Welcome back, and thank you again for being in Business 121, Financial Planning and Money Management. We are going to discuss goal setting, and then spend a little bit of time talking about the time value of money, specifically the future value of money. But let's get started with goal setting. Because if you study highly successful, highly effective people, they don't have to be famous. Maybe they're somebody who is very famous within their little small group of whatever that you're interested in. People who bowl for a living or make horseshoes or whatever. And then, of course, the very famous individuals like Steve Jobs and Elon Musk and other entrepreneurs who are famous because their companies are so successful. When you study these individuals, almost to a person, you will find that they are goal-oriented. They have a vision, they have a dream, and that's important, don't get me wrong, but they work to make that dream, that vision, into reality. And so we want to learn from them. We want to learn how to be effective and successful people, whether we're famous and fabulously wealthy, that's not important. The important thing is that we realize our visions, our goals for ourselves. So, of course, this is a financial planning class, so we're going to concentrate on financial goals, but we're also going to write a few non-financial goals also. Let's start on slide number 19, developing personal financial goals. The types of financial goals include those that are influenced by the time frame. Before we know anything else, we have to know what the time frame is, the time frame in which you want to achieve your goals, and influenced by the financial need, the priority that drives your goals. And that one, people have a tendency to forget the priority. They know internally what their priority is, but we want you to write it down. So we'll discuss short-term, intermediate-term, and long-term goals on the next slide. But look at this one, last bulleted section here. Financial goals should be realistic, be stated in specific, measurable terms, have a time frame, have a priority, and indicate the action or actions to be taken. Now notice that is all italics, so that's very important, right? But don't worry, because we're going to go over this several times. We're going to take a look at a rubric and look at our assignments and look at well-written goals. So you'll see many examples. But we need four things. They must be stated in specific, measurable terms, have a time frame, have a priority, and indicate the action or actions to be taken. That's the part that people have a tendency to slack off. And they must be realistic. But how do we know it's realistic? You're the only person who can know it's realistic. So slide number 20. As we said, before we do anything else, we have to understand the time frame, because that determines the actions. In the industry, you will see various different definitions of what short-term, long-term, and intermediate-term are. And the book's definition is this, and this is very typical of the financial industry. Short-term is up to a year or so. Intermediate-term is 2 to 5 years, and long-term is more than 5 years. And, I think they're a little too rigid. For me, short-term can be anywhere from 1 to 2 to even 3 years. Because as you get older, folks, yeah, exactly, time seems to go a whole lot faster. Einstein said that time was relative, and he was absolutely right. The older you get, the faster it goes. So for me, short-term might be 2 or 3 years from now. Intermediate-term might be 3, 5, 6, or even 7 years. And then for me, long-term is 10 years, 20, 30 years. And what we noticed, as we said, is that within the financial industry, brokerage firms, mutual funds, 1 year or so is short term, 2 to 3 or 4 or 5 years is intermediate, and anything 5 years or longer is long term, whereas the life insurance industry takes a little bit longer view. They seem to be more in line with the way I look at the world, or maybe I should put it the other way around. Okay, so remember that. What's short term, what's intermediate term, what's long term, and understand that these amounts are a little bit squishy and you decide which ones you choose. So here's an example, slide number 21. This is an example of a well-written, effective goal. And we'll discuss that later on when we get to the rubric, but here are some good examples. Pay off the squeezia. I mean Visa. Sorry. Pay off the Visa. What's the balance? $3,500. How did we get $3,500 on that darn credit? Oh, yeah, there was the trip to Cancun. Boy, that didn't turn out so well. She was a real witch. And then the car, had a baby, and his sister needs a new transmission, and the books. Oh, my goodness, I can't believe how much I want for a book for these stupid classes. So is it easy to get $3,500 on your squeezia? I mean, Visa? Yeah, it is. Is it easy to get it off? No. That's because the insurance companies want to put their needle in your arm and suck out your blood, but we'll discuss that in a later chapter 5. What's the time frame? Within 12 months. Which time frame is that? Short term, intermediate term, long term? Right, it's short term. 12 months, short term. What actions do we need to take to get there? Reduce dating and clubbing to twice a month. Aw, man. You mean we gotta stay home on a Saturday night? Cancel the cable service and the mobile phone. You millennials. You would rather eat barbed wire than cancel your mobile phone. Can you at least get a cheaper plan? And stop buying coffee at $5. I'm sorry, $4. Starbucks! Right, Starbucks. And pay an extra $300 per month. Priority is high, very high. We want to get this monkey off our back. And so we said it's a short-term goal. How would we measure the success of the goal? Well, of course, is the balance paid off within 12 months. And the most important question, but one that I can't answer, no one else can answer except for you, is the goal reasonable? Well, for some young folks who don't think twice about throwing away $100 on a Friday or Saturday night and do that maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 times a month, or have a huge mobile phone bill payment, or go to Starbucks every other day. Yeah, it's very reasonable. But for other people who have two kids and the car and the house mortgage or the rent and the orthodontia, are you out of your mind? Where am I going to get an extra $300 a month? So what's reasonable is what's reasonable for you. I can't decide. You have to decide that. So you like that goal? That's an example of a well-written goal. When we get to the rubric for goals, we'll see some well-written goals and some not so well-written goals. Here's another example here. Slide number 22. Save up for a home theater system. What do we need? $2,000. Is that enough for a home theater system? Well, folks, I'll tell you, electronics have come down quite a bit, and you can get a pretty darn nice screen and stereo system for under $2,000. Now, of course, you could spend a whole lot more. But $2,000 it's not a bad amount. Time frame, 12 months. Again, short term. Actions to be taken, take a part-time job at Home Depot, and put $150 per month into a special savings account at the bank. And priority medium, you know, I'm looking forward to it, but if it doesn't happen, it's not the end of the world. Is this a well-written goal? I think so. It tells us, could be a little bit more specific about how many hours we're going to work at Home Cheapo, but for the most part, it's a pretty well-written goal. Now, is it reasonable? Well, probably, depending on how much time you have to work part-time to make an extra $150 a month. But what would most Americans do? Yes, would we bother to wait 12 months? No, use that little piece of plastic that's hiding inside your wallet or your purse. And later. Slide number 23. Here's another well-written goal that is near and dear to my heart, and I hope to put it in yours. Save for a down payment on a condominium. amount needed $15,000. Is that enough? Well, for a small one-bedroom, two-bedroom condo in the South Bay, first-time home buyer, good credit, a decent job with the prospect of being able to find another job if you lost your job. Right, it's actually enough. Talk to the real estate agents. They'll be happy. Now, of course, they want you to have more, and maybe the parents, the grandparents can kick a little bit more in to help. But that's the start. You got to have something. You got to have somewhere to start. And the action, I mean, the time frame is 5 years. So is this intermediate, long-term? Either one. You could say either one, and I'd take either one, intermediate or long-term. Actions to be taken. Set up $200 automatic investment per month to be taken from our checking account with an expected rate of return of 7%. Priority high. We would love to have to be able to get into a home in 5 years. Will $200 per month at 7% be enough to reach this goal? We're going to learn that today. We're going to learn how to calculate that future value of the stream of investments that we've made. That's called the future value of money. So hang on. Don't get ahead of ourselves here. Now, slide number 24. Here is an example of a non-financial goal. And again, as I said, we're going to concentrate on financial goals, but we'll also do some non-financial goals because they're important also. Be able to do 15 good push-ups. Now, what are good push-ups? You know what good push-ups are. None of this back swaying back and forth with your butt up in the air. No, you have to keep your back straight all the way down, all the way up. And this was my non-financial goal many years ago when I took the health fitness appraisal class, which sadly we don't have anymore, but the gentleman who, the professor who ran it is retired, and he was a really sharp guy. And he said to me, you know, Piano, you're doing okay, you got a lot of cardio exercise, but your upper body strength is pitiful. You need to be able to do 17 good push-ups. And I said, okay. So I set a goal for myself to be able to do 15. I could do 7. Do 15 within 3 months, so very short term. And here were the actions. Start with 7 push-ups 3 times a day and increase by 2 or 3 push-ups every 3 to 4 weeks and work up to 15 push-ups within 3 months. Medium. You know, I wanted to do it, but it wasn't the end of the world if it took longer. Is this goal reasonable? Well, for some people, yes. For some people, no. Again, you have to determine. And in this case, you might need some help from a professional who might say, you know what, you need to go a whole lot slower than this. You need to go a whole lot slower than this time frame. You need to take more months. Or no, you can do this in a few weeks. You're good. So, did I accomplish my goal? It turns out, yes, I did. I was able to get up to 15 good push-ups per day by going through this goal. And I was doing fine until I had a shoulder injury. It had nothing to do with the push-ups. It was something completely unrelated. And sure enough, right, you go back to square one, and I had to wait a few months. But this is what life is like, folks. Some of your goals you'll realize, some of them you'll not realize, and maybe you'll have to go back to square one and start all over again. But what's sad, in my humble opinion, is the situation where someone says, you know, someday I'm going to do this. Someday I'm going to climb Mount Everest. Don't do it. It's dangerous. Someday I'm going to ride my bike across the country. Someday I'm going to have a home. And what's sad, you know, these are great dreams, folks, great visions, but we want you to be successful. We want you to realize your dreams. Huh? How's that? Huh? And I have set a goal for myself that I want this class to be the best class you have ever taken, either face-to-face, online, doesn't matter. You understand? Well, obviously, you know, it's a little over the top, isn't it? But It's sincere. And what are the time frame? Well, I'm on it, folks. I'm doing it right now. And what are my actions? I will do whatever I need to do, continue doing the best to make the assignments as relevant and as important as possible, to make the presentations as accessible and useful and informative as possible, and make the exams, we got to take an exam, you got to have a summative, formative evaluation, but I want the exams to be also instructive too. So that's my goal. And so at the end of the semester, you tell me whether I got anywhere close to it. And obviously, you can't be the best for everybody, especially, you just can't. You can do the best you can. But that's my goal. And as I said, it's sincere. So now, let's ask ourselves. Slide number 25. Which of the following goals would be the easiest to implement and measure its accomplishment? Okay, so A, B, C, D. And in the face-to-face class, we pass out these A, B, C, D cards and ask people to show up A, B, C, or D, depending which one they believe. Of course, it's San Diego State and other places that have a whole lot more money. They have a little button you press, and the number of A's light up and number of B's and whatever. But anyway, we don't have that, so we just do low-tech, cheap. So which one would be the easiest to implement and measure its accomplishment? A, spend less so we can save more each month. B, save $10,000 for a down payment on a condo. C, save $100 each month to create a $4,000 emergency fund in 40 months by canceling the cable service. And D, save enough for a $4,000 vacation next year. Now, in the face-to-face class, when we actually have people, raising their hands and the like, a lot of people are going to pick A. Why? Because it's squishy. Because it gives us lots of wiggle room. It allows us to say, oh yeah, we saved a little bit less this month. And, we spent a little bit less this month so we could save a little bit more. But you see what's missing? Specific actions. Time frames. A specific goal. A measurable goal. So the real answer to this question, the real answer to this problem is letter C. And so what I'm going to see, when I'm going to ask you to create goals and you're going to submit them to me and I'm going to turn them back and say, this is not specific enough. Be specific. Avoid vagueness. Avoid vagueness like the plague. And we'll discuss this more and more when you go to the rubric for goal setting. So you're going to do that, right? It's in the, as you walk through Canvas or on the web, on the class website, you'll see the rubric for goal setting. There is a commentary to listen to, and it shows you some examples of well-written goals, which we've just seen a few in this presentation, and some examples of not so well-written goals. And so you're going to write the best goals ever, right? I know you are. I'm proud of you. Slide number 26. So, having discussed the different types of goals and the well-written goals, what is the financial goal of most Americans? And, of course, in the face-to-face class, we ask people to raise their hand. Not even to raise their hand. Just call out. What's the most important financial goal of most Americans? Retirement. Buy a house. 2.3 kids in the yard with a dog, RV, higher education for the children. These are the things we say are our most important financial goals, but our actions speak louder than our words. The financial goal of most all Americans is to spend everything that we earn. Yes. And then spend some more. What? Wait a minute. Most Americans live beyond their means. And if you listen carefully enough, and depending on which household you're in, you might hear a conversation along these lines. They usually will not do it in front of you, so you have to sort of sneak up on them. Honey, can we make it to the next paycheck? Well, we could have if you hadn't taken your sister to a day spa for $400. Well, you bought those golf clubs and we already had it. What's the number one reason for divorce in the United States of Armenia? I'm sorry, United States of Armenia. Money. I would have thought it was hanky-panky, but yeah, it's money. And so, why? how do we do this? Why do we do it? Well, you know how we do it. We are in the United States of America, in the great American economic machine, and part of that machine is credit. And they make it, oh, so easy, and there are 10,000 images being bombarded at you to spend every last dime you have and then spend more than you do it, than you make with the credit that you have available to you. So why do we do it? Well, it's part of our culture. And we're being bombarded, as I said. I have a hard time believing this, but 10,000 different images. Yeah, it's every day. Well, if you watch the television, it makes sense. Everything is buy. So here, after today, your most important financial goal, what will it be? You know what it'll be. It'll be spend less than you earn, right? Now, you know, as I said, every day you're being bombarded, and I only have you for a semester here, for a class here, so I'm going to give you four of these. You decide which one you want. Either spend less than you earn or live beneath your means. Don't live beyond your means, as most Americans do. Don't live within your means. Live beneath your means. Our third our third little thought to put in the back of your eyelids and never forget is pay yourself first. And this is probably the most effective one because it's an action. Pay yourself. Before you pay the cable bill, before you pay Nike, before you pay your cell phone, before you pay $5, $4, $5, pay yourself. And we'll discuss the 10% rule in a minute. But then my favorite, because I'm a child of the 60s, the 1960s, is make love, not loans. And you younger folks might not know about this, but during the Vietnam War was make love, not war, and then you saw make beer, not war, and make art, not war. But I like make love, not loans. So which one do you like, huh? It doesn't matter which one you decide, but you need these, folks. You need one. Because when you go out there into the world, as we said, we're being bombarded every day to spend, and use that credit card. So when you're in that fabulously exclusive French department store, Target. Yeah. When you're at Target and the woman or man behind the counter says, would you like to put this on your Target card? You say, no, I spend less than I earn. Oh, no, I live beneath my means. Oh, no, I pay myself first. And my favorite, as I said, is, no, thank you. I make love, not loans. And they look at you and they go, that's funny. Yeah, right. So you understand? Yes, put one of these. I don't care which one you use. I like make love, not loans, because it's a joke also. Actually, there's a little backstory to this. I got it from my father, who used to tell, he's a joker too, and he used to tell people make love, not loans. And then later on, I said, well, you know, he learned I had saved some money up, and he said, well, that's good. I said, well, I learned your lesson, make love, not loans. And he goes, well, it's a joke. I don't know anybody's actually done it. I've never done it. I said, well, Dad, I have done it. So you decide. You decide which one you want and make it your own. Pay yourself first, though, on slide 28. It's actually the most useful, shall we say. By having the money come out of your paycheck or checking account automatically, most individuals easily adjust to investing. You see, it works like a pay raise, only in reverse. You hear people who have been out in the industry for a while and have a house and say, you know what, things are okay, I'm doing all right, but if we just had an extra $300 a month, or I got that 5% raise, everything would work out. What happens when they get that 5% raise or the extra, right, they go broke at a higher level. You go to the bankruptcy courts and you see people who are in bankruptcy, making $200,000 a year. I'd like to know how you wind up in bankruptcy making, well, it's actually very easy. Spend $250,000 a year, $300,000 a year, and soon enough you'll wind up in bankruptcy court. You see, many financial planners recommend saving at least 10% of your income for long-term compounded growth. And, you know, many of the people have done this in the industry, but none better said it, in my humble opinion, than David Shulton in a book called The Wealthy Barber. Now, this book is from the mid-1980s, so it's out of, the numbers are all wrong, you know, the numbers are wrong, but the concepts are spot on, and Mr. Chilton's jokes are even worse than mine, so that's a bad sign, but a good sign for those of us who love bad jokes. But he does a very good job of putting down the concepts. Not all the, you know, they don't do everything that we do in this class. It's a 3-unit class. But he does a great job of doing the most important. So if you can check it out at the library. I don't know if it's still for sale, but it's a great book, and I don't get any kickback from Mr. Chilton. So is 10% a reasonable goal? 10%? Again, what's reasonable is what's reasonable for you. And this is why we love to get the young folks started early, because for them, 10% is very reasonable, because they don't have all the accoutrements of the middle class lifestyle yet, and they can inculcate. You like that word, inculcate? It means to surround yourself and immerse yourself. They can start early saving 10% and then adjust their spending accordingly. Now let's set the stage on slide 29. The wealthy barber is a barber in a Midwestern small town, and he's very wealthy, and most of the inhabitants of the town think he has inherited money, but no, he's built his empire, so to speak. He's built his wealth by himself. He started out at very small means, but at age 25 started investing 10% of his salary, and now he's 60 years old, 35 years later. And he's now still works. He still works part time, but he helps the younger folks learn about financial planning. So it's a very Midwestern, as I said, down home type book, and so it's a great read. Do it. So here's the wealthy barber explaining to his new students the magic of compound interest. $30 a month, a dollar a day, can magically turn into over $1 million. And you know what is even more impressive? You know someone who has done it, Roy R. Barber said proudly. 35 years ago, I started my savings with $30 a month. That was approximately 10% of my earnings. I have achieved just under 13% year return per year. In addition, as my income rose, my savings rose accordingly. $30 a month became $60, then $100, and eventually hundreds of dollars a month. You three are looking at a very wealthy man. One of my early students only followed the pay yourself 10% first lesson. He bought the wrong life insurance, abused credit cards, overpaid for his mortgage, did not take advantage of his 401k at work, and lost all $15,000 of an inheritance playing the commodities market. Oh, this is a real upbeat, encouraging story, Roy, said Tom. Today, his net worth is $850,000, Tom. $300,000 of it is the equity in his house, but the rest is his 10% savings. He did everything else wrong, but, Kathy started, because he had saved 10% of each paycheck and invested it for long-term compounded growth, today he's in great shape, Roy finished. Yeah. Slide 31. In this chapter, we're going to learn how to calculate the future value of money. We're going to learn what compounded growth, compound rate of return can do for us. And the book has this little discussion of the rule of 72, which you may have already come across and may come across again in the future. It's nice to have, but we're going to be much more precise. If you remember this, great. If you don't, you can skip this slide, okay? But the quick and dirty method for calculating compound interest, compound inflation, compound rate of return is simply divide the interest rate, the inflation rate, the return rate into 72. And that is approximately how long it will take the amount to double. So for example, we get 10% rate of return, 10% interest. You take 72 divided by 10, and that's about 7. It's a little over 7, 7.2 years. It'll take about 7 years for your investment to double if you earn 10%. Let's say inflation keeps at its 30-some-odd-year rate of return, rate of inflation of 3%. Let's say inflation stays about 3%. It's actually been a little less since the Great Recession, but it probably will go back up to 3%. 72 divided by 3 is 24. So it takes about 24 years to prices to double if inflation runs around 3%. And one of the items that is just follows the inflation rate like a clock are cars. One of the items is automobiles. If you go back 24 years, 25 years ago, you'll see that cars cost about half of what they cost today. But we're going to get more precise. We're going to learn about the simple versus compound interest on 32 and how to compute compound interest. You may have come across the simple interest formula, and we will deal with this back in Chapter 5 in detail. That's interest equals principal times rate times time. So if we have $100, we'll take $100 times 6% times 1 year, that's $6. So in 1 year, you have $106. Yippee, right? But the next year, we have compound interest. You earn interest on your principal, but also on the interest that you've earned. So the next year, it's $106 times 6% times 1 year. Or $6.36, and after the next year, you will have a whopping $112.36. And I know what you're thinking. Big deal, Payan. It is. Over time. Because what we're discussing now, and we're getting into the definitions, and make sure you've gone through the study guide and learned about how the study guide works, is the time value money. We're discussing the time value money. It's the increases in the amount of money as a result of interest earned. Now we're going to discuss future value, also called compounding, because that's more important to us in the financial planning class. In the introduction to investments class, we discuss discounting, present value. That's a little trickier. And it's not that important. I mean, see, go through the, if you're so inclined, go through the exercises in the book and the material in the book. We're not going to cover it. It's there for you to look at if you want to. But as I say in the study guide, just ignore it. We're not going to discuss it. More important for us is future value. And what does that tell us? We talk about an amount now, and what will it become in the future? That's that simple. Yeah. What is an amount we put into an investment, into the bank, into wherever, and earns a rate of return at compound interest? What is it going to be worth to us in the future? The present value is a little trickier. What is an amount that we will receive later worth to us today? Huh? Yeah, ignore it. Don't worry about it. But it's just the other side of the coin. Is you just flip the coin and you're on the other side. And again, when you take the Business 123 class, which you'll take someday, right? you will use this extensively because it's a very, very powerful concept for pricing and valuing investments. So let us spend our time, though, on future value. Slide number 34. The amount to which a sum you invest now will increase based on a specified interest rate and time period. And as we said, it's also called compounding. We're compounding our rate of return into the future. And we can do it for two different scenarios. Either a lump sum, single payment, single amount, lump sum principal, single principal. They all mean the same thing. One payment. Or a series of payments, a stream of investments, annuity. I don't like that word. It's true. Annuity is a series of payments. But the problem with annuity is it's also a product, a life insurance product from life insurance companies. So people get confused between the product and the fact that annuity is just a series of payments. So we really should get rid of that. But we leave it in there because you're going to hear some people use that term. But we're going to use the terms series of deposits, stream of investment. I like stream of deposits, stream of investments, because it makes me think of a river. And rivers start small, and then they get bigger and bigger and bigger until they, yeah, exactly. Start investing now to take advantage of the future value of money. Here are the formulas. Don't worry about the math, folks. We mere mortals use the future value of money tables. But here are the formulas. And I show you the formulas not because I want you to do exponential notation, but because of the exponent right here. What is this, right? When a number is up in the air like that, it's called an exponent. And what's the exponent in both of these formulas? Time. Right, time. I'm still learning how to use this little laser pointer thing. I apologize. Time. And you know what an exponential curve looks like? It starts off slowly and then starts to rise and then goes whee up into the air. Time is the exponent. When you're young, time is your ally. Time is your friend. When you get older, time becomes your enemy. Time is no longer on your side. And that's why it's so important to get young folks involved in this idea of investing now for the future. Now let's take a look at present value. Again, as I said, don't worry about it. It's not that important for personal finance, and we use it extensively in Business 123, Introduction to Investments, but it's simply the other side of the coin. And it also has this really strange verb, discounting, right? Why do we? It has nothing to do with discounting at a grocery store or the mall or somewhere, you know, a department store. It has to do with taking money that you will receive in the future and bringing it back to the present. So again, we can do it for a lump sum or a series of withdrawals, and ignore it. But the reason we show it to you is not only because you're going to hear people talk about it, but also because the formulas are the inverse. Instead of time being on the top of the division here, time is now in the exponent at the bottom. And what does that mean? That means it's the exact mirror image. It starts off slowly and then goes really down far. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, don't worry about it. Don't drop the class. We're not going to do any present value calculations, but you are welcome to do them if you go to the library and use the book there. You don't have to buy the book, but if you buy the book, you could do some present value calculations. They're essentially the same as the future value calculations. We use the present value or the future value tables, but again, we're not going to do any present value calculations, so don't drop the class. Don't go screaming into the night. And so now in our face-to-face class, we would stop and pass out the future value handouts and do these together. So what you're going to do now, and you can do it now or later, but you're going to do these problems. And please don't ignore them. Don't blow them off, so to speak. Do them. And if you have any problems, that's why I get paid, folks. Contact me or go to the Academic Success Center or go to the business tutors or the accounting tutors or even the math tutors. The math tutors will say, we're not supposed to do business, not supposed to do finance. You show them the problems and they'll go, I can help you with this. And what you're going to find, folks, what you're going to find is that you, as lucky members of the great American economic machine, have at your disposal investments that have for over 50 years done very well. 10, 11, 12, 13%. And what does that mean? That means you can build substantial wealth. Yes, you can. You don't have to go on some stupid game show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, or win the lottery, which is not going to happen, so don't even try, or start a business, which you may do very, very well and become the next mogul of finance or IT or internet or run up a bunch of credit cards and wind up in bankruptcy court. So as you being a teacher or a fireman or delivering the milk or whatever you want to be when you grow up, you can build a large accumulation of wealth. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, what you're going to find is that you're going to need to do better than a bank. Yeah, right. Exactly. And so when you go through these problems, you'll see that the rate of return that we use is 10%. And often, but not always, the face-to-face class students will say, well, where are you going to get 10%? And if they don't say that, I'll eventually ask the question. After we've seen what kind of wealth we can build over time, I'll say, okay, folks, now where are we going to get 10%? Huh? Slide 39. Hope for your future. You see, dear students, as lucky members of the great American economic machine, you have at your disposal investments that have done better than 10% for more than 50 years. And here are just a few. Now, these are not the only ones. No, by no stretch of the imagination. But these are all over 50 years of returns. These have been around for more than 50 years. And there's just not that many of them, because a lot of them that were around 50 years are no longer here. And there's a whole history behind that. But let's concentrate on the ones that have survived, that have done well. Look, 1967, 11.3%. 1950, 11.5%. 1965, 10.3%. 12, 1967. 1966, 11. Let's go down here. 1934, almost 12% from 1934. And then looky here, T. Rowe Price, a very good company, almost 13% since 1936. Yeah. Rerun the problems in the worksheet at 12 or 13% and see what happens. Yeah. Now, am I telling you to go out and run out and buy these? No, not at all. We're not going to get to investments for quite some time until about two-thirds into the semester. But we'll refer to these and we'll say, look, you know, even with all the horrible things that are going on and the horrible news that we see every day, the news overarching has been good. More people as a percentage of the world's population have come out of poverty than ever before in the history of the world. And that bodes well for us. And especially for those of us who are investors, right? Indeed. Okay, now, so relax. Don't go out and run out and say, I got to go invest in, I got to go invest right away. And take your time. And even after this class, you're still going to have many questions. And that's why we have Business 123, Introduction to Investments, which you might decide you want to take now, because you can take both of them at the same time. But it's a good idea to take the second one after, especially if your time constraint is are strong, if your time is very limited. But the news is good. And as we said, we're going to focus on the positive. Be optimistic. Look optimistically towards the future. Did I mention that there are no guarantees? Yeah. Did I mention that the world could end, right? That there could be a tsunami or nuclear war or meteorite or Ebola or earthquake or disco could return? Yeah, I know some of you laugh, but you weren't there. You don't know. Yes, there's no guarantees. Once you move into the world of investments, there are only a few that are guaranteed, and they don't return 10%, dear students, 11 or 12%. These, just as a side note, these are what we call mutual funds, and we'll discuss these in detail later on. Don't think you got to run out and learn about mutual funds right now. But these mutual funds invest mostly in United States companies. Why? Because those are the ones that have been around the longest. There are others that invest outside the United States. Right, and so the world is global, and we'll discuss this. I'm getting ahead of myself, I apologize. The problem is I can talk about investments a whole lot longer than any reasonable person would ever want to listen. But we'll get back to investments. But the idea is you can do it. Start early, Be consistent. Don't panic. We'll learn how to deal with the volatility in the stock market, which is a fancy way of saying, I just lost a bunch of money. Yeah, it's something we have to learn how to deal with. But you will. You will. Now, go back over. Make sure you can do these calculations, future value calculations, because they're going to be on the exam. But more importantly, they show you that what is available to you, especially if you're young. Because when we come back, we're going to discuss the financial aspects of career planning and take a look at what is your most important financial decision that you will ever make in this lifetime. Right. Are you excited? I hope so, dear students. I, again, want to say how privileged, honored, happy, proud all of us at Southwestern are that you are here with us, and we're going to do our best to make this the best class you've ever taken. I know, a little over the top, but it's sincere. See you at our next presentation on the financial aspects of career planning and your most important financial decision.